200 years since they invaded Aboriginal land.
The land belongs to us. We belong to the land.
Government is trying to take away from us.
Don't call me a problem. I am not the problem. I have never left my country, nor have I ceded any part of it.
Let's talk. Triple A's flagship program that continues to elevate the diverse voices of First Nations people across the country. Centered around the unceded sovereignty of First Nations people in this country, honouring the history with a solutions-based focus on the future. With your host, Pomeroy journalist, Danny Tierce Johnson.
Yama, hello, and welcome to Let's Talk today. I'm your host, Danny Tierce Johnson, Gomeroi journalist. I'd like to start the show by paying my respects to the traditional owners from the lands that we broadcast from, and I'd like to extend that greeting all across this beautiful black nation of ours to your elders past and present. Today on the show, we are talking about the federal election, only a couple of days away. God help us all. It's been a big campaign. It's been a big 6 weeks in the lead up. And today, I woke up to the news this morning, and it's been talked about in the last couple of days, that Australian women will decide the federal election. They'll decide who our next Prime Minister is. And today, I'm joined by Michelle De Jong. Michelle established her consultancy business back in 2008 after extensive experience in both public and private sector. She's a real leader. Michelle has held senior executive positions spanning the public service, including roles such as the National Manager for Indigenous Services in Centrelink and Senior Advisor in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. Michelle, hello.
Hi, nice to be with you this morning.
First of all, sis, your mob and your country, please.
Yeah, Cookie Allenji mob from up north, and I live on the lands of the Walkaroorkabar people in Townsville, but really nice to join you here today.
Yeah, thanks for coming in at late notice. We were meant to speak to a couple of our senators this morning, but a couple of changed of flights and whatnot this morning. So Michelle's kindly stepped in, and it's been such a I call it a weird election campaign. It's been real different from the last ones. As a strong black woman, Michelle, what's your take been on the federal election this year?
Well, I guess there's plenty to digest and to unpack in terms of what we've seen over the last few weeks. So I think we are definitely seeing an election that's really based on some of the kind of squabbling and the undermining of people's individual personalities and backgrounds and things like that. But also I think, some real challenges and conflict around what the different party policy positions are. And for me, that's one of the things that, you know, I'm encouraging mob to do whenever they sort of have a yarn about who they want to vote for and stuff. I said, we got to do the work, you know, we got to actually read what these parties are putting out for us, because otherwise, if we don't do that, we then live by the consequences of whichever party ends up taking government.
Yeah. Can you tell us about some of the work you've done over the years? Because, I mean, you have been in Prime Minister and Cabinet, you have been in the front line of policy and politics, which I think is amazing. But can you tell us, like, some of the work that you do and how that relates to our mob voting?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, I reckon if anybody ever says, why do I care so much about politics, I'd think about those early days back in Townsville, you know, growing up in North Queensland through the late 80s and early 90s. And I always say that's where the political seed was sown. How could it not be with our black politics, our activists and our leaders in our community, you know?
Because Townsville's always been a very racially divided town. A lot of politics up there.
Well, that's
between
right.
Whites and blacks, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, those are the sorts of things that I was exposed to as a young child, and some of the challenges about, like, you know, fighting the system and making sure that the system was more inclusive of us. So I guess in some ways that was really always going to be my trajectory. I ended up moving to Canberra, got into the public service because I was really interested in, you know, the mechanisms of government, and became a public servant for, I probably served about 20 years as a public servant in different agencies, but it also included ATSIC. So I was one of the elected members for the ATSIC Regional Council. I was probably one of the youngest ones across the country at that particular time. But for me, that was sort of understanding these political systems and the way government works. Because on the ground, I think we can get a little bit disillusioned by that big, you know, the system of government and how policies are developed and all of that sort of stuff. And then, you know, ultimately probably just continue to pursue political engagement, Indigenous affairs, and then I went on to do research, and I was I've got a degree, a political science degree, which focused specifically on Indigenous women and the participation of Indigenous women in our political space. So yeah, been very blessed.
Yeah, what have you found around that, Indigenous women in the political space? Because, as I said, one third of Australian women are undecided about their vote, it's been reported. And our women play a big part in that, you know. Well, we don't have the numbers, you know, that that white Australia has, so to speak. Our vote is very important.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's really important to understand is that just generally, the research will always show that women make better leaders. Yes. They make better leaders because they're more inclusive, they're more compassionate. They are thinking around probably 10 steps ahead in terms of the diversity of what happens when, you know, situations occur, how policies might affect people. So just generally having women in our political system is absolutely important. And we know that for a long time white women have had access to that, right? But black women were kept out of that system for such a long time. And so I really did my PhD research just prior to the 2013 election.
Yep.
And what we'd seen at that point was there had never been an Aboriginal woman in the federal parliament. But what we had seen was a real energy and progression for women's representation at the state and territory levels, right? So Northern Territory was smashing it in terms of Aboriginal women in their political parties. And, you know, we had Marion, of course, who was the deputy chief minister for a period of time.
So I was a journalist up there then, and it was, it was strong black women in parliament everywhere.
Everywhere, but it wasn't transitioning to this federal level, right? So I think for me, one of the things that the I took on that research was about saying, so what are the things that we need to do as black fellas, but also as women, to support each other to be able to stand for election, right? And that means things like understanding the strategy, getting mentored, what does it look like to be in political parties, you know, all of those sort of things that become enablers to that participation.
Yeah. It's really interesting when we look at I guess the demographic and the diversity within the parties of black women. Seems to be a number in Labor and the Greens. We seem to more flock to those areas, and I don't think there's any black women in the Liberal Party that I know of.
None that come to mind at the moment.
Oh, maybe just in the Price, sorry. But, you know, it's different yarn, that one.
That's definitely a different yarn.
But, yeah, we don't see women going to the Liberal Party, black women. Is there a reason why, do you think?
I think there are a couple of reasons, and one is that different political parties accept gender initiatives around quotas for representation. It is my understanding that the Liberal Party does not, and also other parties put in place affirmative action measures. So they really go out and try and increase the levels of women candidates and support them to be high on the ticket. And what we have also seen through a couple of different parties, and you've mentioned the Greens and Labor, of course, are also parties that support affirmative action, not only of women, but also of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Yeah.
So I reckon that what we're seeing now is really a kind of the coming together of those many years of that systemic change and putting the efforts in to put in good candidates, good black women. And, of course, here in Queensland, we've got a few of them already either in our parliament or definitely running in this election.
Yeah, we see it in state politics. We see a lot of black women, particularly in New South Wales and Queensland. But in the federal, as we said, it's not transferring, but the rise of the independents, they're going to be a force to be reckoned with. The teal vote, I've been learning about colours through this election, you know, this election campaign. The black vote, whether we go for the red, the blue, the teal or the green, which is a really interesting way to look at voting. The rise of the independents.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think firstly I'd say that we've never really had anybody enter into our formal political systems as Indigenous people as an independent in their first term. What we've often seen is that people have come in through some of the major parties,
yep.
and then eventually there's that conflict between party position, right, and where your value sits, yep. and that has often meant that people have then stepped out to become independents. But that's probably true of society itself, right? That there's a disgruntlement towards some of the policy positions. Others are saying there's not much difference between the two parties anymore.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, interpretive, I suppose. And so independents are now obviously seeing an opportunity to tap into situations and priority areas that the community's talking about. And independents are saying, well, we need this voice around this particular thing, and that's why we're putting our hand up. And I guess that that's appealing to the voter, right? Because the voter's saying, well, you know, I'll put an independent first because that's something I'm absolutely passionate about,
mm-hmm.
and then I'll preference to the other parties. Whereas for a long time what we saw is it was just the two major parties as being our only preference. And I think, you know, it is time for change, and you know, we have seen lots of progressive politics across the world, and it's really showing up in this election campaign that Australia's on board for that conversation now.
Yeah. From a political science point of view, are the two parties similar? Are they the same? Because a lot of our mob do say that, oh, you're voting for the same thing, or you're voting for the lesser of two evils. That they have those sort of yarns, and for our black women, they sort of have to vote for two white men, in a sense, you know?
Absolutely.
So I think about all this sort of thing. But from a political science point of view, what's your take on it?
Well, no, I still think that there's a significant difference between the two parties. Well, I mean, oh, look, I don't want to kind of diminish the contributions of either, but I think, you know, that ultimately what we can see is big business, corporates, you know, building or privatisation, those sorts of things tend to be a policy of a particular party, which is how they run the world, right? We can see that money is the motivation. There's lots of
blue-collar versus white-collar sort of stuff.
Yeah, and then, you know, I know that for many black fellas, we've obviously grown up probably with a bit of a labour background because we relied on unions for rights-based representation. You know, we look at sort of one of the things, I guess, about the two parties might be people who think about penalty rates.
Mm.
You know, one party is probably more likely as a union-based party to support the rights of workers, and the other is probably more about, well, no, the outcomes are not about penalty rates, they're about production and capitalism.
Mm.
So, I mean, I think they are very, you know, broad kind of broad descriptions,
yeah.
But, you know, I think for anybody, whenever you're asking those questions about the two parties, the real issue is, what am I passionate about? So for me, obviously, I think they're poles apart when we are talking about Indigenous affairs,
mm-hmm.
that there are definitely things that we have become frustrated about over the last three terms with a Liberal government, the constant rejection of not only the voice to Parliament and all of the Uluru stuff, but just our voices, you know, the constant kind of pushback that's received through the Liberal government, I don't think has helped us progress very far in Indigenous affairs, and in some ways we've moved backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that both Labor and, of course, the Greens with Lydia's leadership have come out with some pretty progressive kind of approaches to what they're willing to commit to in this election.
I love Lydia now. I know Lydia's got a you know, critics, but if she wasn't in there, how boring would Australian politics be? And I just appreciate that she gets in there and rattles the cage, so to speak. You know, and some people don't like that. It might be seen as polarizing, but I really appreciate it.
Look, I think it's always a fine line, right? When you want to be a politician, and you know, the great Neville Bonner was the first example of that when he said, you know, how dare you ask me to leave my race behind? You know, that this is who I am, this is what I bring into this space. And every Indigenous politician since, whether regardless of their party, has had moments where they've been really conflicted by those very things, because our identity, the way we come together, our commitment to community, our collective responsiveness to each other is what's innately in us. Mm. And so, of course, when you step into a political role, that's always going to be a challenge. And that's why I think the one thing that has been great to watch probably since 2010 up till now is, of course, the numbers of Indigenous people in the parliament, right? Yeah. So as Ken returns in 2010, we then get Nova in 2013, and then we kind of get a bit of a roll on with Linda and Pat and, you know, others. So you've kind of got the opportunity then to be supporting each other in that political space, regardless of party lines, and that's always very difficult for others to understand, but... You know, the Indigenous solidarity and the Indigenous caucus can be really important to support our mob that are in some of those difficult spaces.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about going into politics yourself and joining a party?
I have, and then I did a really long PhD and decided that it probably wasn't for me. And I probably like my weekends too much. That's probably the
only thing. I always wonder, like, that, you know, as a black fella, you go in there with the best intentions. You want change. You want the treaty. You want to solve the housing crisis, you want to stop deaths in custody. And then you get in there and you join a party and there's so many different priorities and things that you have to do. And obviously, you know, you have to represent your constituents who are majority white fellas and minority, other minorities, you know. So it must be really difficult to be in there and just keep that line going of representing your community but also your constituents and then towing the party line, so to speak.
Yeah, look, and I think those are the complexities that others probably don't appreciate, right? So on one hand, you are an Indigenous person in this space. So the first thing is that you've got to convince others that you can represent more broadly for the constituents of your electorate. So that's probably one of the first hurdles. Then the second one is, you know, recognising when can you kind of speak out around Indigenous issues and how does that then play out for your constituents and do they feel that that was what they elected you for? And then, as you say, then you've got the complexity of the party and your obligations to the party. So you, as a politician, you don't cross the floor too often, so which is why it's really interesting at the moment. We are seeing candidates across all of the different parties and, you know, you can't bag somebody for the choices that they make in terms of what their political affiliation is, because clearly what they're doing is saying that's the party I'm most likely to be able to work with those parameters. And yes, they know what they're getting in me, but it means I'm going to align with that. So, you know, that I love walking around at the moment and just seeing all the core flutes around with blackfella faces on it, you know. I mean, we're probably... I haven't seen the latest statistic, but I think we might have maybe 16, 17 Indigenous candidates running across the country.
That's great, isn't it?
With the potential to have maybe 9 in Parliament.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a big deal because remember I said I did this PhD just leading up to the 2013 election and we had Ken was in there and we'd never had a woman. So... we've certainly moved a long way. So as much as I look at the kind of disadvantage placed on us as blackfellas in the political system, I also want to champion the results that we've got in such a short period of time because she's kept us out for a long time.
Yep.
And now we're showing you we're holding our own.
Should we be more patient with our Aboriginal senators and Torres Strait Islander senators in federal parliament? So the criticism is once they get in there, they don't really do anything, you know. A bit of a toothless tiger on some issues. Some of our senators, you know, they say the right thing, but then we don't see any change. Do you think we need to hold them to account, or do you think because of the political landscape, do we need to be more patient with them?
Well, that's a pretty good question. Look, I think at some point we probably do need to recognise that everybody goes into politics. I don't know that I've ever seen a candidate that says, oh, you know, I want to go in there because it's working really well and I just want to be a part of that. Most people will always go in there saying they're not doing X, Y or Z, right?
Yep.
And I'm going to be the person that can make that change. But the problem is that what you do is you step into this big political machine. And so as much as you want to bring your energy and your views to particular things, it then gets lost in the machine. So I think we have all had those experiences. I do think we need to be a little bit patient with our political representatives, but at the same time, they are elected to do a job. Mm. So just like anybody else, if we don't feel like we've seen the change or it hasn't worked for me in terms of how I've seen that vote play out, then I'm going to make a different choice the next time.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of the game.
Yep. Because it is really interesting. Like, you know, I've been pretty disillusioned with our Minister for Indigenous Affairs, particularly some of his comments around the Kumanjay Walker case and once that was handed down. And it's been a pattern over the years since he's been in. And it makes me think about it. Will we ever get to the day? Well, we will one day, but in the near future, about having a black woman as a Minister for Indigenous Affairs and what that would do for our mob. We were talking earlier around, you know, women make better ministers because of all the reasons that you said earlier. And I sort of wonder if there is a change in parties over the weekend when it comes down to the vote, and there might be a chance that someone like Linda Burney or Malandiri could become the new Minister for Indigenous Affairs or Indigenous Australians. Mm. Do you think about that and what that could look like?
Oh, believe me, I've given that lots of thought. Yeah. it sounds nice when you say this weekend, you know, it's getting closer to the reality. I think, look, one of the things is in some ways, as a black fella with the Indigenous Affairs portfolio, that's a double-edged sword, right?
Know,
so
right?
We got black fellas all over this country been trying to solve all the issues for a long time and frustrated. So then to be the portfolio holder across the complexity of all of that, I mean, you know, Linda was on record when she first took on her New South Wales parliamentary role and she said, I do not want the black portfolio because what I want to do is prove that I am a politician in my own right and I have interest in a whole range of other areas, which is why she was like the families and children minister for a long period of time,
in
fair
New South
trading,
Wales.
All of those sorts of things.
That
yeah,
was very
right?
controversial. So, her time as Child and Family Services Minister because the Indigenous child removals rate spiked under her.
Yeah, so it's kind of, it does it, at the end of the day, you're going to have a portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's always going to come with its challenges. I think the reality of a black woman as the Indigenous Affairs Minister is almost a fait accompli if Labor get in, because I don't think we could go back to having a non-Indigenous.
Well, that's my point too, you know, even though it's a double-edged sword or a poison chalice, this portfolio, we don't want a white fella doing it.
Well, that's right. So there's the first thing we've got to check off our list, right? So that's what we're not going back to. And then I think we've got significantly capable and brilliant Aboriginal women in the party that are probably setting up to do that very thing. And, as you say, you know, women make better leaders in that. Women will be more inclusive in that. The way that they make their decisions around those things, I hope, will manifest into a much more progressive Indigenous Affairs portfolio under a woman's leadership.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Yeah, I hope it happens. You know, it's going to be really interesting come Monday morning and see where we're at. You know, it's only a few days away. And you know, I'd love to see it. I'd love to see a change in that seat. So let's hope Monday we can talk about, some interesting things. Can we talk about preferences and how they work? Are you sort of...
Yes, we can.
Because I always, like, you know, and a lot of people ask me, it's like, oh, if I vote for so-and-so over here, is that really voting for so-and-so over here, the way preferences get handed out and get passed down? So if you vote for the Greens, is that a Labor vote? If people vote for One Nation or Palmer United Party, is that a Liberal vote? You know, and it's just how that all works and gets broken down. It's I think our mob find it really confusing, the whole preferencing thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's one of the most important parts of our political system, our electoral system. In some ways, our electoral system doesn't necessarily support the representation of minority interests, right? So this is the first challenge, because if we look at things like New Zealand, they have a mixed member proportional vote and all of that sort of stuff, which allows us to vote a bit differently. But in this country, one of the things that's really important is the preferences. And the first thing that I would say is parties make their own preference deals. So, like you mentioned, if I vote for Greens, does that mean that I'm really voting for Labor?
Yep.
Well, in some ways it does, if that's where the preference deal has occurred between those two parties, right? So that's the agreement that has taken place. But what happens is when you number the vote, you're actually defining where your preference is. So You could say that you want Greens, and then you might number an independent as your second and another independent as your third, and then maybe Labor as your fourth. So that way it's saying, actually, my preference isn't directly to Labor. My preference is to these other parties, yep, or to these other people. Now, this probably plays out the most in the federal election. So we all are very familiar with the small ballot that, yep, comes for the House of Representatives. But it's that big white piece of paper that you get that kind of goes on forever.
Chop down half the Amazon to make all the voting.
I know. I'm sure we're going to have
it. It's like 3 metres long, and you got to like put the X's and the ones and the twos and whatever it is. It's like it's a bit of work.
Absolutely. So the best way to describe that is above the line is actually where all of the parties are listed, right? So if you vote above the line, what you're saying is you're happy with the way the party has ordered the nominees on the ballot box, right? So if it's the Greens and it's Ben and Mary and John and Bill, for example, then they're saying that is the order in which, if the Greens get the most votes for their Senate position, they're going to go down the line in that way, mm-hmm, right, in terms of who's going to get in. When you vote below the line, it's then up to you. You are deciding who are your preferences regardless of party. So, you know, there might be 30 boxes below the line. What you now have to do is you have to number 12 of them. But I did notice recently, like, there's a First Nations party, yeah, with a number of candidates in the Senate. So this is where you start to say, oh, my preferences might be to one of those major parties, but then I'm going to give some preferences over here to this First Nations party because I want them to be in with a chance, and a couple of independents so that we've got a balance in the Senate.
Yeah.
So to me, if I do anything with any groups I get together, it is to teach people about the preferential voting system and how much it matters. So, you know, a lot
it's
of our
really
mob...
important, right?
Right.
Once our mob go to the polls this weekend, I really want them to go, you know, who's ever listening to this show, go there with an understanding and a bit of knowledge around what all this means when they do vote.
Yeah, and so a lot of times when we have community elections, people will just look at the percentages and they'll go, oh, well, that person got the most votes, therefore they're in. Mm-hmm. But what you actually need is a majority. So preferences become really important when you haven't attained the majority in the first count, right? So what happens is if I'm 5% shy of what I need,
yep,
the count is then going to go to the second phase, and people who have preferenced me, those votes are going to be the things that get me across the line.
You can scoop them up.
That's it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
that's really interesting. What happens if we muck up the form or if we be silly because it's the old donkey vote?
Yeah, well, that was going to be my next yarn. You must be reading my mind, because I get really frustrated with people who think that that's actually beneficial, and it isn't. It means that we are, you know, and I know that Blackfellas will make their own choices about what level of political participation they want to have, and if you choose not to participate, that in itself is your own choice. But what's important for me is I think about that legacy piece, you know, about what we wanted, what our mob wanted for us, that we should have the same entitlement and therefore the same vote, or the same right to vote as anybody in this country. So, you know, firstly I say to Blackfellas, would you prefer to be back there? Would you be... you know,
yeah,
happy that they're just excluding us still, or are we going to make this vote count? So one of the things is, if you muck up the form in true error, then you go back to the polling officer and you say, I made a mistake, can I have another form?
Yep.
But if you mark anything else on that ballot box other than the numbers, it will be considered an informal vote or a donkey vote, right?
Yep.
And all that does is it just changes the number of votes they need to get in to get their majority. So think about that. When you're doing that, you're actually making it easier for some of the people, the parties to get in.
So a donkey vote is actually a bad vote.
Yes.
Basically.
Yes.
Right? Because it's going to someone that you probably don't want it to.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm saying if anybody does... takes anything away from this yarn, take away the fact that preferences matter.
Yeah.
Either above the line you're voting for the party, or below the line you're voting for the individuals, but either way, preference them all the way through 1 to 12 or 1 to 6 above the line, or your whole ballot for the House of Reps.
Is there anything else our mob need to know around sort of polling on Saturday and the voting? I always found it when I was a younger fella, it was just a nightmare. I hated going to them because you get all the people, they're waving up all the, what do you call them, the core flutes?
Yeah.
You know, and people are getting in your face and telling you what to vote for, and then you go in, you got all these bits of paper, and if you struggle with literacy like I have over the years, it becomes a nightmare and it becomes really stressful.
Yeah.
What else do our mob need to know to arm themselves with the knowledge and the education, the information to go and cast a proper vote?
Well, look, I think part of it is just preparation, right? Mm-hmm. So if you don't like that intensity of election day, then you've got the opportunity to pre-poll. So those pre-polling booths are open now, and that kind of gives you back your Saturday. Others might absolutely love the adrenaline of an election day and be sitting up there ready to, you know, have the election night party.
My auntie in Sydney used to go down to the Marrickville voting booth and just say she could have a row with all the call flute wavers. She loved a row on election day. And it was her chance to, you know, send her a message around black politics. So shout out, auntie, love you.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's the other thing, right? So most of those people are volunteers or affiliated with the party reps. And, of course, our system just wouldn't work if there wasn't somebody out there trying to advocate for the candidate that they want you to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
But my advice is if you do the work beforehand, you kind of know where your two party, you know, if making a choice between two parties, what do you want to know about it? I've done the research, and then I go, oh, those mob are handing me out that. I'm going to walk over to them and get the information that they're giving me because that's going to tell me. Or I already know and I just walk past them and don't engage.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit of what do you call it? It's like running the gauntlet in some ways. How do you want to approach it? Have a strategy and just make sure, you know, that you stick to your strategy. Or head down, get through it.
Yep.
Because you also know that there's a certain boundary by which those people then can't enter, and that's why they're always outside the gates. So you know once you get in the gate, you're cool. You can have a bit of a breath and then you can get your head together before you get to the actual polling booth.
No, that's really good advice. Hey, I just wonder, in the last 5 years, have you seen an impact on American politics, on Australian politics, in terms of voting? So we've seen the rise of Trumpism, MAGA, you know, on almost a real racist line in politics that's become acceptable across the globe within the right and the far right sort of movements. Have you seen any impact here in Australia and then how that affects us?
I think the short answer is absolutely. Mm. And, you know, that's because that's for a long time I think that we were very separate from the American political system. Obviously it is a different system, but we didn't take on so much of what was happening in the American political scene in the Australian one, right? Mm. But now obviously the consumption of political information has increased so much because we've got access to it. We've got access through social media and, you know, that our news cycles were also sharing everything that was going on in America. And, you know, as blackfellas, none of that is foreign to us. And in some ways, the thing about racism in this country was that for a long time it was quite subtle. And then there were particular political people who entered our parliaments at different times who have absolutely allowed the overt nature of racism to come to the top and continue to do so, right?
Yeah.
So it's not new to us, but I think what it is doing is it's preparing a society to accept that overt racism, and we're finding ourselves trying to push back on some of that. And that's always going to be a challenge with politicians as well around where does their party position sit on some of this stuff, you know, what do they stand for? What's their no tolerance position?
Mm-hmm.
How are they supporting minorities? How are they pushing back on racism in this country, you know? So the short answer is yes, and I think that it's probably going to get worse. And unfortunately, I think when we look back at this election, we'll probably see much more of that American influence and the far right than we are even predicting now.
And particularly religion as well. Mm. You know, we're seeing that real Americanism with religion. It's starting to enter our politics, particularly with our current Prime Minister's relationship with Hillsong.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't seen these things before. It's always been a little bit of separation, but, and, you know, just it has an impact on our people in politics, our senators, and our mob when we go to vote.
Yeah.
I just think it's really interesting.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, a couple of those examples can be easily dealt with if you put in the other systems like Corruption Commission or other things that are the checks and balances in our political system, right? And I think that that's one of the things that the Australian community wants to see. Mm. We want to make sure that there's transparency and integrity in our politics. And at the moment, the question is, I don't think we've got that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that might be the way that the Australian community then says, well, you haven't heard our voices, so now this is the one chance we get to say, well, you know, every 3 years we get to either leave you there or make a change. And, you know, the Australian community, is, I hope, does the right thing this Saturday.
Yeah, please.
It's always a fine line when you're trying to talk politics and stay on the fence.
Yeah, I'll just ask you, just lastly, just to wrap it up, but I just want to ask you around the Uluru Statement from the Heart, and that's place in federal politics. Now, it got shut down the day after the mob sort of, you know, came together out there at Uluru and put this out, and got shut down by the Turnbull government at the time. Where do you think, is that something on your radar, something you think about, the impact of the Uluru Statement from the Heart in federal politics? And that was driven by the referendum council and under two, you know, very strong black women in the co-chairs, Pat Anderson and Megan Davis. What do you think about the Uluru Statement of the Heart, and what can that do for us in federal politics?
I think it's a defining moment in our history already, right? So one of the things is that we have, so if we look back at the last referendum around these particular issues, that was kind of a simple referendum because we were just saying, take these discriminatory bits out.
Mm-hmm.
But the interpretation then of how that applied to us has brought us to this situation where we know that there needs to be change in our constitution, but that change needs to be supported by reform. And I think that what came out of the Uluru gathering was a fundamentally new way of us saying, these are the things that are important, these are the three main priorities for us as Indigenous peoples, and this is the way forward. We don't want to deviate from this yarn, we don't want another policy kind of idea, we want to say these are at the forefront of what we want to do in our political representation. So the challenge, of course, is under a Conservative government, most of that was shut down very quickly because people use the scaremongering tactic. Now, let's just call it as we see it. The scaremongering tactic of saying it's another chamber of the parliament. It's a bit like, I don't know if you remember, but back when the Mabo decision came out, right,
mm-hmm.
and all the newspapers around Queensland were, blacks are going to take your backyard, or blacks claim the Torres Strait, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And that's the scaremongering without the detail. And I think that that was kind of where some of that initial pushback went out into the Australian community and people were hesitant. But there have been a number of very solid individuals, as you mentioned, and those supporting them that have continued to gain the leverage around the Australian community, to educate them. And so I think that absolutely we need a voice to Parliament, and I also support the fact that that voice needs to be constitutionally enshrined so that we can make sure that with the change of the next government or the one after that, that all of our progress doesn't get taken away.
What does constitutionally enshrine mean for the mob out there going, what's that mean?
Oh, so basically what it means is if you put it into the constitution as part of our political system, you then have to go to a referendum to change it, right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to each government, when they come into power, can kind of decide on whether things exist or don't exist. They can terminate at will. So what we don't want is a voice to Parliament that doesn't suit the next government of the day and that they can't terminate it when this term is up.
So it's there forever.
It's there forever. And that's what it means about being in the Constitution. And then all of the other things flow from that around treaty negotiations with the Makarrata Commission. And at some point, this country needs to tell the truth, right?
That'll be the day. I love it, hey?
Well, let's get that voice in there first.
Is there any advice you'd like to give to black women out there? Obviously, we're not going to tell people who to vote for, but anything that you want to say around the federal election this weekend before we wrap it up?
Yeah, look, I mean, my advice is just to all our mob that, you know, we are in the best position ever to make the contribution to our political system, because I don't know about you, but I'm tired of being the recipient of really bad policy. Huh. And what we need to do when we take this vote is vote for people who are going to do right by us. And, of course, those other things that are important to you. But mostly what I'd say is show up, do your democratic duty, support each other in that process, and make sure you number all those boxes so your vote counts.
Yeah. Thanks so much for the yarn today. It's been brilliant. You've given us a really insight into federal politics, our mob voting, the preferences was a great yarn. So thanks so much for coming, Michelle. I'd love to have you back talking about federal politics more because you've got an amazing brain on, yes.
Thanks. No worries.
That's Michelle DeShong talking federal politics, voting this weekend as we decide a new government or the old one. Who knows, my people? We'll find out. But you've been listening to Let's Talk, Triple A Murray Country.